Our second case for this morning is Larson v. UnitedHealthcare, 12-1256. Mr. Krueger.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. At its core, this is a narrow case about insurance companies complying with a state law-mandated benefit. We carefully pled this ERISA case to name the insurance companies as the defendants. We did it on purpose. If you'll indulge me for a minute, I will explain why.
But while you're explaining, I want you also to address the following point. It's not at all uncommon for cases like this to name what I'll call the plan administrator, and sometimes the plan administrator is an insurance company, for decisions that are within the realm of its discretion. But this is not that kind of thing. This strikes me as a plan design decision, whether it was a good one or a bad one, or whether it complied with Wisconsin law, or whether it didn't comply with Wisconsin law is the next question. But plan design is never handled the same way. So even though there might be a case in which an insurance company might be either a plan administrator or otherwise a proper party, I'm not sure if it's this one.
But the plan has no say, Your Honor, so I'm not exactly sure.
The plan had every say. The plan contracted with the insurance company. Is this a perpetual contract?
No, but the plan, the insurance company had to sell an insurance contract that complied with Wisconsin law. And
that's
the insurance.
That's a different question, though, than the duty under ERISA. That's a state insurance question.
It sounds like, Your Honor, that you're asking about a fiduciary duty question. I'm asking the question of who do I sue for benefits due under the terms of the plan? Who do I sue to enforce my rights under the terms of the plan? Who do I sue to clarify my rights under the terms of the plan?
And your basic complaint is the plan entered into the wrong contract with these various insurance companies, it seems to me.
No, my basic complaint, Your Honor, is the insurance policies are the terms of the plan. In fact, Blue Cross Blue Shield calls itself the plan. No one disputes that the
but
policies.
You agree that there's this prior contract. The plans of these various employers contracted with these major insurance companies. And yes, once the contract is in place, perhaps the employers were saying, you know, look to the terms of the insurance policy for the details of what kind of coverage you're going to get. But there's a transaction between the employer and the insurance company that gets the ball rolling.
But, Your Honor, say I could find the plan, which is generally, assume it's just the employer, and we sue the plan, and we get a judgment. The plan has no say. The plan has no authority to reform the terms of the plan to comply with state law.
I don't
only
understand that, though. I mean, if it's not a what's the duration of these contracts? Is it yearly or 5-yearly?
We have not seen the actual policies. We have the certificates of insurance that are issued to the people. We only filed a complaint, Your Honor. We didn't get discovery. I assume they're typically 1 year. They may be more than 1 year.
So if they're a year contract, then the plan can change. You can tell the insurance company we want to buy a different policy. Premiums may change. Coverage may change. Some of you think it will go up. Some of you think it will go down. I don't know what it will do. But why isn't that a very meaningful?
What if the plan doesn't want to change, Your Honor? What if the insurance companies don't want to change? The plan as an entity doesn't pay any of the obligations. So if my client sues and wins against the plan as an entity, whatever that is, the plan doesn't pay anything.
If the plan has been told by a court that it has to cover chiropractic services in a particular way, I will note that we're not really talking about this Wisconsin statute yet, then presumably the plan has to comply with that court order and buy the right kind of coverage. Why wouldn't that be?
Why would the insurance company have to comply with that court order, Your Honor?
The insurance company is a provider of a service, but the plan is telling it what contract it wants. Presumably these parties negotiate.
But that still leaves my client with no remedy for anything it's paid in past? I mean, Your Honor, this has like a Wizard of Oz quality to it, in that when you pull back the screen, it's the insurance company. The insurance companies control everything. They pay the benefits. They're the entity that it's regulated by Wisconsin law. They're the entity that makes all the decisions on whether they comply with Wisconsin law. They're the entity that makes all the decisions on what you pay. They're the entity that sells it. I don't even know if they sell an insurance policy that doesn't have copayments for chiropractic care. So when we try to take it and say, well, this is just the plan, you can find the plan, whatever that may be, and sue the plan, I don't think that an injunction against the plan isn't going to be enforceable against the insurance company who underwrote the policy, who administers the policy. A judgment is not going to be enforceable against the insurance company in the sense that the insurance company can always say, wait, I want to litigate that issue. Essentially what we're saying, Your Honor, is my clients have to sue the plan and hope they bring in the insurance company, who then steps in and takes over the defense.
Well,
my claim, Your Honor, is under the statute. No, nothing under the statute says I have to do that. The statute says I can recover benefits due under the terms of the plan, enforce my rights under the terms of the plan, and clarify my rights under the terms of the plan. The policy are the terms of the plan.
Well, let me move on. Obviously, if one of my colleagues has more questions about this, that's fine. But I'm not sure how much good it would do you, even if we were to take a pretty liberal approach to our court's previous law about suing insurance companies. Maybe it's moving in this direction. Let's just assume under some circumstances you can sue the company. I find it very hard to look at your brief and not think that you are asking for special benefits for chiropractors, not equality. You want there to be no copayments for chiropractors, and yet there are copayments for licensed physicians and osteopaths. So why do they get this special treatment out of a statutory provision that certainly reads to me like an equality rule?
Well, because they don't have equality now, Your Honor. So let's start from that standpoint.
No, let's start from the statute. The statute seems to say equality.
Right.
If physicians have copayments, why shouldn't chiropractors?
The statute says you apply deductibles and coinsurance provisions on an equal basis.
And it also refers to cost containment measures, which some people think copayments are.
And I do not think they are, and there's no evidence that they are. Cost containment is normally, if you have a broken arm, what type of measures are consistent among physicians? What will they pay for the broken arm? It's limits on chiropractic visits is normally cost containment.
Well, the reason copayments are is because people are supposed to think twice before they march off to a medical provider and asking them to pay some amount of money. Usually copayments are, you know, not that much. They're not $100. They're maybe $20, $40, whatever they are.
Same as coinsurance, Your Honor. Coinsurance has that effect as well. But there's a reason that the legislature says coinsurance and it doesn't say copayments, and this case illustrates it, where the insurance company set the copayments at a level that far exceeds the actual cost of care.
So I understand that this is your argument about illusory coverage, because if somebody's told you have to pay $60 if you run it through your insurance, but you only have to pay $45 if you just pay the chiropractor for the visit, who's going to run it through the insurance? I mean, people aren't going to be foolish, so they'll just pay the $45 and keep it out of the insurance altogether, right?
Correct. There's no benefit. And the copayment, by the way,
that assumes all chiropractic visits are one payment and one payment only, whereas in fact chiropractors offer a wide variety of services. They have x-rays, they have ultrasounds, they have other things. Some visits may be well over the copayment level, some visits may not be. Same thing is true for physicians.
Well, we provide an example in our complaint, Your Honor, of them not being a detailed example. So I think we go discovery on that. That's a pretty intensive factual issue to which we have not been allowed to go to. All of our plaintiffs are people who are paying copayments that far exceed the cost of care. And Plaintiff Larson, the example that we set forth in the complaint of paying $475 and the insurance company WPS pays about $43, is not an outlandish example. It's a common example, Your Honor. And I should also point out, Your Honor, that the difference between copayments and coinsurance is significant to your benefits. That $473, many of the insurance companies do not apply that to your deductible. They do not apply that to your out-of-pocket maximum. So it just goes on, and you just keep on paying it. Some of the insurance companies, you continue to pay copayments, even if you reach a deductible and out-of-pocket maximum.
So what do you do with this provision of the Wisconsin Insurance Code that says, you know, that which isn't prohibited is permitted? The only thing the statute that we're focusing on says is this paragraph does not prohibit the application of deductibles or coinsurance provisions, but the Wisconsin legislature took the precaution of trying to defeat the very inference that you are urging in 600 point whatever it was.
I believe that's not correct. I believe mutual benefits, the Wisconsin case, rejected that is not, which is not prohibited is allowed type of argument, Your Honor. The Johnson case, Johnson versus Burmaster, pointed out that doesn't answer what is actually prohibited. And when you read the statute, and 600.12, Your Honor, which is actually entitled Construction of Insurance Statutes.
But how do you read, what does 600.011A mean if it says what chapters 600 to 655 do not prohibit is permitted?
It means you read the statute to figure out what it means, Your Honor. All they say is because
construction.
And when you read the statute, it says it mandates coverage for chiropractic care. The mutual benefits case is crystal clear that when a statute mandates benefits for chiropractic care, the legislature assumes the insurance company is going to pay those benefits subject to the limitations set forth in the statute.
But it also says, well, nowhere does the statute say copayments are prohibited.
And nor does it say they're allowed. And when you read the statute, Your Honor.
And then you read 600.01, 1A, and since it doesn't say they're prohibited, then they're permitted.
No, Your Honor. When you read 632.87.3a, section sub 1 would make no sense if section 3a did not prohibit or otherwise limit deductibles and coinsurance to start with. Because the legislature went out of its way to make plain that the main paragraph does not prohibit the application of deductibles or coinsurance provisions to chiropractic and physician charges on an equal basis.
Maybe that's what the legislature thought was worth underscoring, since deductibles and coinsurance are very often much bigger than any kind of copayment. You might have, as you pointed out, you know, lifetime limits. You might have, you know, an 80-20 split on coinsurance. You might have, you know, whatever, you know, a $500 deductible, people might worry about that much more than a $50 copayment. Yeah. So, if the legislature has singled out things that it wants no ambiguity about, legislatures do such things.
But then you're basically arguing, Your Honor, or the conclusion would be that the insurance company can provide any copayment it wishes to. It can be a $200 copayment, $800 copayment, Your Honor?
It would certainly be a point at which your argument about illusory coverage would have some teeth. I'm not sure on the face of this, though, we can see any reason to think that's the case.
If we were to read it the way you say it should be read, wouldn't that put us at odds with the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance in Wisconsin?
The Commissioner of Insurance, in our view, has made no formal interpretation of this statute. And I have to actually point out, Your Honor.
You're stressing the word formal, though. Judge Tinder's referring to quite a bit in the record.
Well, the OCI fact bulletins say expressly do not rely on us. There is the OCI regulation, the number just escapes me, but it does set out a copayment structure of $35 for specialist, $25 for physician, and $11 for chiropractic. This would support our other argument, Your Honor. Either way, I think what's being missed here is they violate the statute. Because if they have to apply copayments, our argument would be they have to apply them on an equal basis. They are certainly not applying copayments to chiropractic and physician charges on an equal basis.
What would equal be? Are chiropractors specialists? Are they general practitioners? What are they?
They're chiropractors, Your Honor. There is no statute.
We're being forced to make a comparison to licensed physicians. So if there's a multi-tiered structure for physicians, we need to know what equality means.
We would argue equality means the same percentage as in a co-insurance example or a co-payment example. The co-payment represents the same percentage of the physician or chiropractic charge. And that is why the right
percentage. Co-payments are normally a flat fee that you pay no matter what the cost of your visit was.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there is an average, and it can be applied on an equal basis. And that is our position, Your Honor. Our alternative interpretation of the statute is that's exactly why the regulation that the defendants point to as a lower charge, a lower copay for chiropractic care, because chiropractic care is that much less expensive than going to see your primary care physician or going to see your specialist. And I see I
would yes, if you want to save some rebuttal time, this would be a good moment for that.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Are you Mr. Lucky?
May it please the Court, Steve Lucky.
Lucky, okay.
On behalf of United Healthcare and on behalf of all the defendants, wish to address in particular why Judge Crabb's decision dismissing the complaint on ERISA grounds was correct. Naming the correct defendant is important in an ERISA claim for benefits in this circuit, and the plaintiff's failure to do that required dismissal of their complaint. Also, designing and implementing insurance policies that fund employee benefits plans is not a fiduciary function under the law of this circuit, and accordingly, the breach of fiduciary duty claim under 502A3 was properly dismissed.
It seems to me the law of this circuit, though, in terms of the party, has been taking a more practical viewpoint such that it really depends on each situation, what is the relation between the insurance company and the creator of the plan? Sometimes it's been this closely intertwined business. Sometimes maybe you don't know, but perhaps sometimes, which I suspect would be the case with many small employers, there is a very tight relation, as there is here, and the insurance company would be a perfectly appropriate defendant.
Under the law of this circuit, Your Honor, when there isn't an identifiable employee benefit plan, as there is in this case, and there isn't confusion about the identity of a sponsoring employer or a funding source, then the plan is supposed to be the defendant in the case.
Well, my point is, you know, we've gotten that far, but then there's the case of Schultz against Avial, in which we said, well, we don't really need to reach the question whether we should take a more flexible look on proper defendants, because it didn't matter there, but it's conceivable that that would be a sense of, that would be consistent with ERISA.
Well, it is, if there is a situation, and this was the court's decision in Moat, if the fact that the insurance company controls and maybe funds the benefit by itself isn't enough, you do need to have the separately confusion about the identity of the plan.
But the Ninth Circuit didn't think so in Sear against Reliance Standard Life. They said sometimes an insurer should be included, even if there isn't some befuddlement about the relations among companies.
That's right. And the Ninth Circuit has now applied a different rule than this circuit. But in response to the law of the question about the law in this circuit, it's never been enough. And particularly in the Moat case, that the insurance company fundamentally controls the decision, as in Moat. What you need to have is confusion about the identity of the plan or an intertwining. Judge Crabb found.
I just want you to argue why that approach is consistent with the statute. I mean, this court is not any more blessed with omniscience than anybody else in the world, and sometimes we take a fresh look at things.
Sure. And I think it makes complete sense, particularly in this case. The plans themselves are the obligors of the benefits here. That's consistent.
Are these one-year contracts, by the way, to answer my other question?
I expect that they vary. But the plan, but the employers, and this is consistent with the definition, this is a plan. These are all plans. This is why this is under ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. You need to have an employer in the picture to sponsor the plan. And they, in this case, by operation of law, all the employers, whether it's Heritage Credit Union, Madison Auto Body, or whatever, are the plan administrators because there is that is the default rule.
But they don't administer anything. The insurance companies call themselves, they call these policies the plan. They evaluate claims for benefits. They say yes. They say no. They interpret. They've retained discretion to interpret. That's what we usually see in administrators of plans.
They often do in terms of deciding claims. One of the insurance policies calls itself the plan, but it's still very clear in the complaint and otherwise that there is a separate identity that's called the plan.
Which is just an empty shell?
It really isn't an empty shell, and I urge the court to review its prior decisions in Mondry and Ed Miniat. In Ed Miniat, this court explained that the job of being an employer and plan administrator in these plans is actually very important. It actually includes monitoring who these organizations are that fund the plan. And so so that is something that, you know, they do have a role in this. In the Mondry case, the plan administrator, the employer, was required to get some plan documents from Cigna. They asked, and Cigna said no, and this court said that's not enough. You have responsibilities as the plan administrator, and they do. And that is why they can fund under Section 3.1 of ERISA their plan through the purchase of insurance, but it's still their benefit.
But the plan administrators don't make benefits determinations.
They don't make.
This is a suit regarding benefits.
I would suggest it's really more than a suit regarding
well,
benefits.
There's more to it than that as
right.
well, but it is fundamentally a suit about benefits and what benefits are required by state law. And there is more to it. There's declaratory relief that is being sought that perhaps would lie against a plan, but the benefits claim does not.
The benefits, but still it's a benefit of the plan that can be funded in whole and part by the purchase of insurance. In this case, the policies provide the benefit, but it's really, you know, more than, this isn't a case such as in Sierra where the question is what is the particular participant entitled to in terms of his or her benefit. This is really goes to what is the design of the plan. What is the cost-sharing arrangement? The employer is paying the premiums on these plans, and what the cost-sharing agreement fundamentally affects it. And so this circuit's rule of applying clear lines is sensible because...
Well, it makes sense that the plan is a proper party. It may not make sense that the plan is the only proper party, and that's the heart of the matter here. And while the Moat case said that that's true, or that's the case for purposes of the law in this circuit, that may not be right as a matter of statutory interpretation.
Well, and I guess I would suggest that since the claim for benefits is pursuant to that is to allow recovery under the terms of the plan itself under 1132(d)(1) can sue and be sued, and any judgment as is enforceable against it does provide a situation where it really does make sense, unlike A3, which is more open-ended and a catch-all provision, that a claim against the plan should be against the plan if there's a question about whether the plan is doing its job.
They can't get a benefits remedy from the plan.
They can. They certainly can, because, first of all, the employer in this case, as in Ed Miniat, if it thinks that the plan is not making a proper decision, can bring a claim against the insurance company for not meeting its funding obligation. If the employer isn't doing its job, the participants can bring a claim for breach of fiduciary duty against the employer who is the plan administrator. So in all of these situations, and of course this circuit has already adopted a rule that allows for flexibility if there is some ambiguity about the plan or an intertwining, but Judge Crabb said, and this decision is entitled to deference.
I think you're eating into Mr. Davenport's time.
I apologize. I was waiting for the yellow light. And thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good May it please the Court, and thank you for preserving some of my time. Your Honor, we do not believe it is necessary for this Court to reach the issue of how to interpret the Wisconsin statute in order to decide this case. The District Court decided the case without reaching that issue, and we believe this Court should do the same. However, if you do reach that issue, we believe that you should reject the interpretation that the plaintiffs, the appellants, are urging. They characterize this statute as a coverage mandate that says insurance policies must pay for chiropractic services. Quoting from their brief, they describe the statute as one that mandates that insurers must pay for chiropractic services.
That's how it was sold to the chiropractic community, as well, I recall.
But that's not correct, Your Honor.
That's a common misperception.
What the statute actually says is, if you cover treatment of a condition by a physician or osteopath, and a chiropractor is also able to treat that condition, then you can't exclude coverage for the chiropractor. It's not a mandate to pay for all chiropractic services. It's a parity requirement. It says if you cover it when physicians treat it, you got to cover it when chiropractors treat it.
Right, and the plaintiffs have a different way of measuring parity. They want it measured as a percentage of the cost of services as opposed to just a flat comparison of copays.
And
why is that a bad interpretation?
Well, because that's not what copays are, Your Honor. Copays are not something that are applied on a percentage basis. As Judge Wood pointed out, copays are flat fees. They're flat amounts. Coinsurance is something that's applied on a percentage basis. So to try to calculate percentages and what percentage of the cost of care does a copayment consume for chiropractors versus how much for physicians is just not an analysis that's mandated by the statute. What the statute says is you can't exclude coverage for chiropractors, and the defendants aren't doing that.
But of course the statute then unhelpfully goes on to say that this paragraph does not prohibit these two things, deductibles or coinsurance, and we've been treated in the briefs to many provisions of Wisconsin insurance law that use those two terms plus the term copayment, and they seem to be shuffled among these provisions. But ordinarily when you're construing statutes, you think that the legislature meant something when they put two things and not a third in there.
And in this case, I don't think you can draw that conclusion, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. One is, as you have already pointed out, we have another provision of the Wisconsin Insurance Code, 600.01 sub 1 sub A, that says whatever is not prohibited is permitted. And the subsection of 632.87 that you're referring to, subsection A1, doesn't say anything is prohibited. It says that coinsurance and deductibles are allowed if they're applied on an equal basis. It doesn't prohibit anything. It doesn't say copayments are prohibited or anything else is prohibited. It doesn't say that these are the only things that are allowed.
But what about the situation alleged in the complaint where the copayment, I'm going to make up numbers because I don't remember the exact numbers, but the copayment is $60, but the cost of the visit is only $45. I mean, that surely describes an illusory contractual arrangement. The person isn't getting a single bit of benefit from the policy. Nobody would pay $60 for the thrill of having it move through the insurance policy.
The problem with that, Your Honor, is that the appellants have not alleged in their complaint facts sufficient to make out a plausible claim that that's the way that the copayment works across the board for chiropractors.
But they have alleged that that's what happens. And don't we get into factual distinctions moving forward? You know, how often is this? Maybe if there's a plausible case that it's a lot of the time, maybe that is a valid complaint. If it's only every so often and a lot of chiropractors are offering more extensive services such that the copayment really is a copayment, then it's not illusory. I mean, how can we delve into all these factual variations?
Well, it is a factual issue, and you're correct that there are a lot of factual variations. And in order to get to that point, the plaintiffs are compelled to allege facts that make out a plausible claim that there's a violation of the statute. What they've done here, Your Honor, is they have picked out a small slice of what chiropractors do. They have focused...
I don't know that, reading the complaint. I mean, you're representing that, and that may be so, but how on the face of the complaint do we know if it's a small slice or a big slice?
Well, because they refer to particular CPT codes in the complaint, the CPT codes that apply to spinal manipulations, which are the most basic kind of service that chiropractors offer. And it's a matter of general knowledge that I suppose that the court could take judicial notice of, that there are other codes that apply to chiropractors and other treatments that chiropractors provide. As you mentioned earlier, chiropractors provide radiological services. They provide evaluation and management services. They provide therapeutic massage, range of motion therapy, all kinds of other things. And so for the plaintiffs to state a plausible claim, they would have to allege that across the board, or almost across the board, or in virtually all cases, the copayment is more than the cost of service. And they haven't done that, Your Honor. So the complaint simply doesn't get them to that point. Now, they've also alleged an alternative theory, or argued an alternative theory in their brief, about the fact that, according to them, the defendants are charging higher copayments for chiropractors than they are for primary care physicians. That's another thing that isn't alleged in their complaint. And we're talking about a decision at the 12B6 stage of the case here, Your Honor, so we need to look at what's been alleged in the complaint. That alternative claim was never alleged in the complaint. There's no allegation in the complaint that even if copayments are allowed by the statute, the defendants are still violating the statute because they're charging a higher copayment for chiropractors than they are for physicians. In addition,
I thought this, at least in the briefs, this allegation was that chiropractors were being classified as specialists, not as primary care.
And that's why they argue that the copayment is higher for chiropractors than it is for physicians, because they're comparing chiropractors at the specialist copayment amount versus the copayment amount for primary care physicians. They've alleged that all of the, or they've argued, I should say, that all of the defendants are charging the specialist amount, but they've not alleged that in the complaint. This isn't alleged anywhere in the complaint. The policies, or at least portions of the policies, were put into the record as part of the motion to dismiss. They show that that's not true, that actually it varies. Some of the defendants apply the specialist rate. Some of them apply the primary care rate, but there's two additional problems with that. One of them is that this is such an intensely factual issue, as you have recognized, that this is a claim where exhaustion is required, where the plaintiffs are required to exhaust their administrative remedies, and they acknowledge that they didn't do that.
Now, would the insurance companies be the provider of those remedies?
The plan would be the one that would provide the remedies if the issue is that you have designed a plan that is contrary to the Wisconsin statute. If it's
I'm just trying at a pragmatic level. Ms. Larson wants to exhaust. Does she present her complaint about lack of coverage to whichever of the insurance companies handles her plan? Or does she go to her employer, or does she go to, you can't say exhaust and have it be completely opaque to people who they're supposed to go to.
The policies provide the specific procedures that are to be followed to pursue administrative remedies.
In the insurance company's
And they
policies.
Go to the insurance company.
Okay.
Right. They go to the insurance company.
Okay. So if you want to give us a concluding thought, I will let you do that.
Well, the only concluding thought is one more thought on the alternative claim about higher copayments for chiropractors than for physicians. And that is that in addition to the fact that it wasn't pled, it also doesn't state a plausible claim, wouldn't state a plausible claim that violates the statute, because it sort of begs the question of which of those two buckets should the chiropractor be put in. And I would argue, Your Honor, that they should be put in the specialist bucket, not the primary care bucket. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Krueger?
Yes, Your Honor.
First, Your Honor, these are fully funded insurance plans. They're not self-funded plans. The plans, the entity they want us to sue, does not pay any benefits. They are not the obligor. That is simply false. The insurance companies pay all the benefits. Second, there is nothing in Section 1132A1B that requires my plaintiffs to have to create confusion to sue the proper party who pays the obligations that are due, who is regulated by state law, and who makes all the decisions. Finally, I just have to address this exhaustion issue that came up at the end, Your Honor. There is no administrative discretionary process at issue in this case. What the copayment is crystal clear. What the policies say is crystal clear. There's no discretionary administrative record for them to review and make a decision on.
There's no provision for waiving a copay?
Well, they would just have to modify the terms of their contract.
So that's not something that can be achieved through an administrative process in an individual case. I guess that's the question.
But if they disagree, which they clearly do, everything would be reviewed de novo at the district court level. And it doesn't create any efficiency to go through an administrative process to ask the insurance companies who have issued these policies, who have defended the issue in front of the OCI when the OCI took a survey about it, Your Honor.
Right. The question is not so much whether it's efficient, but whether it's futile.
For those reasons, it would be futile, Your Honor. They've already, the futility question is, would they change their impression? And they've already defended this in front of OCI and said they're not changing it, that copayments are allowed, and they've defended their copayment practice, Your Honor. I have nothing else, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel, I should say, and we will take the case under advisement.